forward to. Good afternoon. I would like to welcome you to today's program, The Power of Political Foresight in Global Economics. Joining us this afternoon is Dr. Ian Bremmer, President of the Eurasia Group. My name is John Wilson, and I am a trustee of the World Affairs Council. A quick word about the Council. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and becomes the basis of informed action. To learn more about the organization, please visit our website at www.itsyourworld.org. If you are unable to attend a program, the Council offers two great ways to stay connected. You may either listen to our weekly radio show called It's Your World on Monday evenings on KQED, or you can visit our website for audio and video recordings of all of our past programs. Today's program is being recorded for future broadcast, and I would like to thank our audio engineer, Mr. John Trinidad. Before we begin, let me take this opportunity to announce an upcoming event. The Council is delighted to announce its 63rd annual conference. Please join us as we gather with political leaders, policymakers, public intellectuals, and diplomats to explore the most crucial global issues facing the Obama administration. The conference will be held on April 2nd and 3rd, just a few blocks from the Council at San Francisco's Westin St. Francis Hotel. Finally, please locate the yellow question cards that have been placed on your chairs. Please write your questions for Dr. Bremmer and hand them off to Council staff members. We will use your questions during the Q&A session in the latter half of the program. Please also turn off all cell phones and anything else that might interrupt our program. It is my distinct honor to introduce our speaker. With an analytical focus on global emerging markets where politics have mattered at least as much as economic fundamentals for market outcomes, Ian Bremmer's career spans the academic, investment, and policymaking communities. Dr. Bremmer has held research and faculty positions at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, Columbia University, where he presently teaches, the East-West Institute, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and the World Policy Institute. After founding the Global Political Risk Consultancy in 1998, he currently serves as the president of the Eurasia Group. An author of six books, including The J-Curve, Dr. Bremmer has published more than 200 articles and essays in the Financial Times and the New York Times, among others. He is also a regular contributor for the International Herald Tribune and Slate, a contributing editor at the National Interest in Foreign Policy, and a political commentator on CNN, Fox News, and CNBC. Here to discuss his latest book, The Fat Tale, The Power of Political Knowledge for Strategic... I think there's a typo there. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Ian Bremmer.
I'm going to stand. I can't sit during presentations. John got the short straw in having to wear a tie during the presentation, but he's a lawyer, so it's okay. It's great to be back, and thank you, John, first for your words, and thank you all for showing up. It's great to be in San Francisco, back in San Francisco. I was at Stanford for a while, and always enjoy the chance to get back to the Bay Area, especially when it looks like it has recently. The name of the book is The Fat Tale. So I'm going to first tell you what The Fat Tale is, and then I want to apply it to the world we're living in today. Fat tales, simply spoken, are the one in 100 year storms that we increasingly seem to be experiencing roughly every 15 minutes. Right? And you know, you have normal distributions, You think that these extreme events and outcomes actually are very rare to occur, but in reality they happen much more. Now, I'm not an economist. Why am I standing up here telling you about fat tails affecting the markets? Well, the reason is because increasingly the world's fat tails that are affecting economic outcomes, that are determining the trajectory of our country's economy, that are determining how our 401ks will do, how the stocks we're invested in will do, what languages our kids should learn, are being driven by politics. That's the whole book. The book is how political risk and political drivers are increasingly mattering to economic outcomes. And I think it's very important to explain right in advance what your axe is. That's my axe. Right? As a political scientist, I believe this stuff. I think politics is mattering more, and it will continue to matter more over the course of the next couple of years. So with my talk today, I'd like to do two things. I'd like to first explain two changes that are happening in the world that make politics matter more in the markets. And then I want to talk about what the fat tails are out there over the course of the next couple of years. And then I'll take questions. That's the whole idea. So first, what are these two things? Over the last 20 years, as an investor, as a decision maker, a policy maker, a corporate leader, a banker, there was one thing you could not afford to get wrong. One thing you had to understand about the way the world worked, and that was globalization. You had to know that increasingly over time, multinational corporations were becoming the most important economic actors in the world, and they were taking advantage of global economies of scale. They were looking to maximize profitability, sometimes long-term, sometimes short-term, labor differentials, global consumer markets, global supply chains. If you missed that, you did badly. Tom Friedman sold 3 million copies of The World is Flat in the United States because he explained that to the average American. By the way, anyone that gets 3 million Americans to read about globalization deserves our thanks. Right? What I would like to argue is that that world where multinational corporations were becoming ever more important and dominant as economic players, it's gone. We are now entering a world where globalization is being increasingly challenged by state capitalism. A world where governmental organizations are increasingly becoming dominant in determining market outcomes. This is obviously true in Washington, but it is also true in other capitals around the world. When Obama comes out 3 weeks ago and says that if we don't get the stimulus right, the United States is facing economic catastrophe, his words, not my words. Another way you can read that is that it doesn't matter what the banks do. It doesn't matter the automotive plans that come up, GM and Ford. It doesn't matter how many hundreds of thousands of people are laid off by different companies. If Washington doesn't get the stimulus right, we are in serious trouble. In other words, if you want to understand what's going to happen with the U.S. economy over the course of the next couple of years, you need to watch not Main Street, not Wall Street, you need to watch K Street. That's shifting. And that's shifting all over the world. It's shifting as national oil corporations are more important than multinational corporations on the oil side. It's happening as emerging markets are becoming more powerful and state-owned enterprises are more powerful, increasingly as a consequence of that in countries like Brazil, Russia, India, and China. It's happening as sovereign wealth funds are becoming more important in allocating capital internationally. But really, it's happening over the last 6 months as we see massive stimulus and regulatory response to this global economic recession. Now, I am not going to stand here and tell you that state capitalism is a bad system, because I'm not going to tell you globalization is a good system. Globalization isn't a good thing. It's a thing. It's just a thing. If you are in Bangalore, you like globalization. You've done well. If you're in Detroit, you don't like globalization. You haven't done well.
I'm really not interested in telling you the relative merits of a person from Bangalore compared to Detroit. That's not really an interesting conversation. It is interesting to note that the average American is much less in favor of free trade and globalization today than they were 20 years ago. That's interesting. It's somewhat less interesting because that's not what's going to determine how policy is made in the United States. That will be determined by corporations who generally are still very pro-free trade, though that may start changing over the next 5 years, particularly vis-a-vis China. We can talk about that. But I'm not interested in making the value judgments. The important point is that we must know that state capitalism is increasing in importance in challenging globalization because it will change the way we think about who the winners and losers are. Right? I mean, just as in Europe, you've had mountains of butter and lakes of milk in governments propping up relatively inefficient farmers, in the United States, we will start seeing mountains of SUVs and lakes of ethanol. And that's actually important because we want to bet with the winners and not the losers. We want to understand what's likely to happen. Before we can manage risk, we need to understand it. Right? So this is, in some ways, this is a very non-political talk. It's not about Republicans or Democrats. It's simply about how the world is changing. That's the first point, is we're moving from globalization towards state capitalism. There's one more big point. Over the last 20 years, we've been in a system where the United States has done a great deal of lifting and has been seen as a unipolar leader. Right? There's been one superpower in the last 20 years, the United States. Increasingly, very clearly, that's being challenged. The political willingness and the ability of the United States to provide global leadership is much smaller than it used to be. President Obama does not want to deal with foreign policy right now. He is focused on the domestic economic crisis. You know, when he was elected, but before he was inaugurated, we were talking a little bit just now about Israel and about Gaza, and before the talk, John and I, and you remember when Israel invaded Gaza, and Obama was in Hawaii, and he was asked, a little demonstration, he was asked, you know, so what do you think about the Israeli invasion? And he responded, well, we only have one president at a time. I don't want to comment on that. It's very interesting. He did not respond that way when he was asked about the stimulus and bailout for General Motors. Now, I'm not trying to suggest Obama's a hypocrite, certainly no more so than any other politician. That is not my point. It's smart politics. My point is he can't be auto czar, health czar, education czar, and secretary of state. That is too much. He's not going to be able to do the same lifting. So, okay, if we don't have the same level of unipolarity in the world, what kind of system are we moving towards? A lot of people think we're moving towards a multipolar system, the rise of the rest, the post-American order. You've all heard about this. I disagree. We're moving towards a non-polar system. A multipolar system is a system where you have lots of different countries that have different interests about the way the world should be run. Some of those are in competition. Some of those are cooperative. We're not moving towards that kind of a system. We're moving towards a system where lots of individual countries have very strong interests about the way their individual countries should be run. They have sometimes very strong interests about the way their regions should be run, and sometimes those interests differ with some of those countries, like Russia vis-a-vis Ukraine and Georgia. We have that. But we're also moving towards a system where there is a general abdication of global leadership. And that is true whether you are talking about nuclear proliferation, or whether you are talking about climate change, or whether you're talking about collective security in Afghanistan and Iraq. A lot of people love Obama. I don't see them putting lots of troops up for Afghanistan. Even Britain said they'd help. Privately, they're talking about 2,000 troops. It's not exactly a surge. Right? Or whether we're talking about global financial architecture and the upcoming G20 meetings. Right? Now, so what I've said so far is that we have these two big global changes that are occurring that are making politics matter more. The first change is moving from globalization towards state capitalism, and the second change is moving from unipolarity to nonpolarity. Now, if there is one thing that I want you to take away from my talk today, aside from lots of books, it is the following. It is that neither of those two systems are equilibrium states. They're not stable. A system of non-polarity and a system of state capitalism together will create greater shocks. The biggest mistruth that we have been spoken in the last year in the United States is when Chief of Staff Obama, Rahm Emanuel, came out and said, this crisis is too great an opportunity for us not to take advantage of it. That's not true. It is insufficiently large. Republicans and Democrats in Congress are engaging in business as usual. Media is talking about this in just in the same way that it has before. We are 2 months in. I had a chance to have dinner, a little private dinner with a bunch of folks and Secretary Geithner last Tuesday in New York. And afterwards, I talked to him a bit privately. Guys under massive pressure right now. We all know that. It's been 2 months. We still have not seen a single political appointee for Geithner confirmed. And by the way, it is singularly unfortunate that Lehman went bankrupt while the U.S. was in the middle of an election. Because I don't care how good you think Paulson was. The fact is, half of his guys were gone, and half were looking for jobs. And Congress was up for election. And that doesn't lead to efficient policymaking. Working with a skeleton crew for 6 months now while you're in the middle of the biggest global recession since the Great Depression. This stuff matters. Now, I don't think there's anyone out here that believes that the nuclear proliferation issue is getting better or is going to get fixed. Right? I don't think anyone believes that. The United States went to North Korea. And they said, if you test a nuclear weapon, we are going to be very, very angry. And then they tested a nuclear weapon. And we were very angry. The anger was palpable in Washington. You should go. They were very angry people. But they couldn't do anything, right? And the Chinese went to the United States and they said, you see, we told you, you should buy these guys off. And we said, yeah, you're right. We're sorry. We'll buy them off. We'll work with you. Now we're in a situation where the Iranians are developing nuclear capacity. And the Israelis may well bomb them. I don't think it's likely, but it's more likely than the markets think. It could happen, right? But if that doesn't happen, the Iranians go nuclear. The non-proliferation regime is completely broken. Now, I can give you some scenarios where it might get fixed. For example, if Hezbollah were to get their hands on a dirty bomb, stick it on a ballistic missile provided by Iran that they now have that can hit Tel Aviv, where 60% of all Israeli Jews live, that could lead to a conflagration where countries like the U.S. and China would say, we don't care about sovereignty. We don't care about what the Iranians, the Israelis say. We are going to resolve the proliferation problem. I can give you shocks where that could happen. Now, the good news is the likelihood of some of those shocks occurring is relatively small. It's thinkable. It's greater than I'd like it to be. It's greater than it was even a year ago. But they're still small. The bad news is, short of that kind of shock, in the system that we are seeing emerging, we are not going to have resolution. What all of this means is greater volatility. Politics will have greater impact on markets. We will see greater inefficiencies in the global economy, but we will see different winners and losers. So, I can talk, if you like, over questions about who the relative winners and losers are going to be, which countries are more resilient, who's likely to get through this global recession more freely, and all that. I'm happy to take questions on that. But in the rest of my talk, I want to actually just talk about three big fat tails, because the book is the fat tail. We know we're in a global recession right now. What are the fat tails from a political perspective that we're going to need to pay attention to? The first, which I already sort of implied, are what I would call the capitals of capital. New York used to be the financial capital of the world. It is no longer the economic capital of the United States. Washington is. Dubai used to be where you would go if you wanted to make money in the Emirates or the Gulf. Very exciting place to be. No more. Abu Dhabi is. They just gave their first bailout. There will be more of $10 billion to Dubai. We used to talk about the Shanghai faction in China, which is where all of the free market, freewheeling, go-go growth guys were. That was where the exciting pulse was of China. Nobody talks about the Shanghai faction anymore. They talk about consumer stimulus, safety net spending, infrastructure stimulus from Beijing. and on and on and on. Those decisions are made not with profitability maximization in hand. They are made with the national interest in hand, and frequently those two things are in competition. That means it is going to be harder for the U.S. to raise money in treasuries from Abu Dhabi and China and Russia in the next 2, 3, 5 years than it has been over the past 2, 3, 5 years, which will create inflation, which will require the printing presses to be turned on in the U.S. That is the first big risk out there. We will see more regionalization of capital flows, not globalization of capital flows, and less efficiency because of the new capitals of capital. That's the first point. The second big fat tail is plain vanilla geopolitical risk. We've been around geopolitical risk for a long time. This isn't new, but there are two things that are interesting. If you compare 2008 to 2009, 2010, with the singular exception of Iraq, which is kind of ironic, almost all of the geopolitical hotspots will be worse than they have been. This has nothing to do with the recession. This is just geopolitical. Iraq is actually getting better. This is the year that Iraq goes probably from being a war to being a peacekeeping operation. To create some balance, it is also likely the year that Afghanistan goes from being a peacekeeping operation to a war. Right? But if you look at South Asia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, even India on the security side, the United States, the Europeans, and others will be engaged in more political capital expenditure, more economic resource expenditure, and lose more lives. And yet the security situation in those countries will be markedly worse at the end of 2009 than it was at the end of 2008. As I mentioned, the Iranians are moving towards nuclear weapons capacity. The Israelis have just put Netanyahu and a right-wing coalition into government. All they pay attention to, when you ask them questions about the economy and the rest, they always come back to Iran. If there was going to be conflict between Iran and Israel, it wasn't going to happen last year. It's going to happen over the next 12 to 18 months. Mexico, I mean, we have narco cartels that have declared war against Calderon and the state of Mexico. That is getting dramatically worse to the extent the State Department, rightly, though a little late, put a travel warning on for Americans to go south the border. We have all sorts of kidnappings and slayings going on in Phoenix. Mexico is under a lot more pressure. I could talk about Russia, Ukraine, and some other spots as well, but geopolitics are becoming more in terms of risk for us to pay attention to. Now, here's the problem. The problem is no one's paying attention to it, right? I mean, when oil was at $147 a barrel, and I went around to talk to some of our clients, the trade commodities, and said, what do you think the oil premium is on Iran? Well, how much is the Iran conflict priced in a barrel of oil? Some people would say 10 bucks, some would say 25 bucks, but everyone was aware and it was part of the price. When oil is 40 bucks, and everyone's paying attention to demand destruction and the financial crisis, no one is paying attention to Iran, which means if it blows up, it will be a greater shock to the market. We'll have more discontinuities. Remember, when the United States invaded Iraq this last time, the markets went up. Why? Because it was priced in. You have 150,000 troops on the ground in the region. Everyone knows war's coming. The only thing they don't know is they have uncertainty around when the attack is coming. The attack finally comes, uncertainty is gone, markets go up. We are not in that environment right now. We're in an environment where we're not paying attention to anything geopolitically. But I got to tell you, if President Obama believes that the single greatest distraction he's going to have over his first 2 years outside the financial crisis is Blagojevich, he's wrong. Very fortunate that in the first couple months he has not had to deal with a major geopolitical crisis. That will not be the case for his first 2 years. And that will be a difficulty. Third fat tail. Director of National Intelligence Dennis Blair came out a few weeks ago, and he focused on the single largest threat to American national security being the impact of the financial crisis on social instability around the world. I happen to agree with that, but it's important to recognize that social instability is not a leading indicator, it's a lagging indicator. In other words, when you have a serious meltdown in the economy in emerging markets and lesser developed states around the world, it typically takes 12 to 18 months for that to translate through unemployment and dislocations into serious social strife and political instability. In other words, we have not seen that yet. Now, some countries will be much more resilient than others. China will be more resilient. The Gulf will be more resilient. Brazil will be more resilient. And those are good places, by the way, to invest as a consequence. But some will be less resilient, and some will fall apart. That's when we will see revolutions and coups. That's when we will see radical dissent and strife. Countries that we might want to watch out for in that regard, places like Ukraine, maybe Turkey, maybe Argentina, maybe Nigeria, maybe Russia, maybe Thailand. Now, in a globalized world where the United States actually has investments in these places, where economies are interconnected, where multinational corporations do business there, that's actually a problem. The Cold War, if the Soviet Union fell apart, no great shakes. The U.S. did not have investments in the Soviet Union. In this environment, you've got a problem because you actually need these guys. Part of the difficulty with state capitalism and non-polarity is that the United States and China are actually married. We don't like it if the Chinese tell us that our kids aren't attractive. But that is the environment that we are moving towards. So, that was about half an hour. I said I'd speak for about half an hour. So I now think we have lots of time for questions. And I would feel free to be as provocative as you like. I'm not shy. Shocking to all of you, I know. And thank you all very, very much for coming. I do appreciate it.
We do have some questions. I would encourage you to keep them coming. This is a dialogue that is meant to be provocative and interesting. So the tougher the questions, the more provocative, the better. And by the way, he asked me to invite you to submit provocative questions. So he's not shy. The first question is really just a sort of a basic question, and that is, is non-polarity a result of the current political and economic situation equally? In other words, with an economic recovery, would non-polarity be less likely, or would it change, or how would it change?
That's a very good question. Clearly, the economics have an impact because the ability of the United States to play a leadership role is severely impacted by the severity and the rapidity of the crisis. So I think that if there is a serious rebound, then you will see more U.S. leadership around the world. But let's be clear. Non-polarity is something that has been percolating for a long time. And part of that is the fact that other countries are out there and growing. And part of the fact is a lot of those countries do not share the same basic values of the countries that have comprised the G7. And part of that is that as that occurs, many of these emerging market countries that are so important for the global economy are immature in terms of their exposure to global decision-making and leadership and architecture. The geopolitics of the world are shifting very dramatically, but the institutions are not. Again, lagging indicator. We have the G7, G8, G20. We have NATO. We have the Security Council. We have the IMF. We have the non-proliferation regime and structure. These organizations have been around for a long time. But the geopolitical structure of the world has changed radically in the last 20 years. Until you get congruence between those two things, you're going to have growing non-polarity. Though, again, with an economic recovery, there will be a buffer against how quickly that occurs.
When you look at countries like Russia, China, Brazil, countries that historically haven't been part of the mainstream of the Western economic powers, do you believe their leadership, their economic leadership or their political leadership, do they have the experience, the talent, the background so that you can have a meaningful dialogue with the traditional Western powers and actually develop a consensus over time around a common plan or at least a consensus on a way forward?
On a lot of issues, no, I don't. And I don't think it's because they're bad people. I think it takes time to build this stuff. And by the way, Japan has this problem too. I mean, Japan is an incredibly mature, industrialized country. MITI, the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, is incredibly strong and probably coordinates industrial policy better than just about any country in the world, any institution. But Japan has anemic diplomacy. They don't have a National Security Council. So you want to get the Japanese involved in a meaningful way in dealing with non-proliferation. Right? And you think if anyone would be good at this, it'd be the Japanese. I mean, heck, they had nuclear weapons explode in force on their territory, right? But they're actually not set up for it. Now, if you look at China, think about the tsunami that hit, right? Indonesia and all over Southeast Asia. And the United States was there with billions of dollars and boots on the ground immediately, and they coordinated with the Indians, with the Australians, with the Japanese. The Chinese, couple million dollars a week late. Huge opportunity just blown by the Chinese government. It's not because they're bad people. It's because they just have no history of doing stuff like that. They've never been a global player. And now we're expecting their economy has created a footprint that makes them a global player overnight, but the institutions aren't there. I mean, you know, Chevron, I'm here in San Francisco right now. Chevron goes into a place like Kazakhstan, and they support junior achievement and women's rights and the Little League and everything else. And you say, oh, wow, that's really great. They're wonderful people. They're not wonderful people. They're oil men, for Christ's sake. But they've been around long enough that they understand that if they don't act responsibly, it is bad for them over the long term. China's multinational corporations weren't multinational 10 years ago. So now they're going into Africa, and they're doing the same stupid things that American multinational corporations did decades ago. And they're going to get hurt. How do we know China's becoming a superpower? Well, we'll know they're becoming a superpower when, you know, you start seeing terrorist attacks against Chinese embassies in different capitals in places like Africa. That's going to happen. But they need to go through a learning process. We're not there now.
Most of the talk so far has focused on the impact on developing, or I should say developed, economies. What does all of this mean for the third world, for the developing world?
I think the first thing I would say is that developing states, we talk about them as emerging markets frequently, don't deserve to be put into a category. The notion that you can invest in an asset class called emerging markets is farcical to me. The BRICS don't make sense as a category anymore. Some of them are going to be very resilient, some of them are going to fall off a cliff, some of them are going to emerge, and some of them are going to submerge. And we need to recognize that. Emerging markets are countries that actually need to have continued proactive policymaking to continue to succeed. A lot of those countries have middle classes that are just starting to coalesce, and in some cases, this economic crisis will cripple those middle classes. In some of those countries, they will be sufficiently resilient to stay on track, and some of them they won't. And you'll see them move towards strong authoritarianism, towards capital controls, and the rest. And that's what we need to watch. I was talking to some executives up in Seattle the other day, and major corporation, talked to, you know, sort of basically their whole sort of management team. And I told them, I said, you know, the 10 and 20 year scenarios you guys used to spend a lot of time doing, don't bother. It's worse than useless, because if it's useless, it'd just be wrong. Worse than useless is when it's wrong, but you actually think it might be right, and so as a consequence, you start allocating resources that way. In this environment, you cannot do that. But the thing you need to do is actively stress test scenarios of 1, 2, and 3 years. And you need to recognize that the breadth of potential scenarios for the countries and sectors and investments that you are exposed in is dramatically wider than they would have been 6 months ago. Discontinuities become much more likely in many of these emerging markets. The breadth of potential outcomes in a country like Russia is enormous right now. It wasn't a year ago. And we need to recognize that.
You can feel free to pass on this one, but I have to ask it because it is an interesting question. And that is, where would you invest your money internationally?
Well, the funny thing is I personally am in money markets in my house because for me to take personal investment decisions creates bias in what I say. Hmm. I don't like that. I don't want to be attached monetarily to something that I'm talking about. I really do believe the psychology behind that is problematic, and I think, frankly, that's corrupted a lot of investment banking research, so we don't do it. But therefore, what do I like? And keep in mind, I'm not an economist, I'm not a strategist, and you still need to pay attention to those things, even though politics is mattering more. So let's assume consensus economics. Where are the places that I think will do relatively well? Well, I already mentioned some of them. So Brazil, which is effectively the Saudi Arabia of alternative energy, of biofuels, will do well in this environment. That's a big offshore, huge oil resources that they're just starting to tap into, and they have a lot of political consolidation. And so they'll be able to take decisions that are strategic and long-term. I generally like the Gulf. I like Saudi Arabia a lot. I like Kuwait. I like Bahrain. I like Qatar. I think they'll be stable. I think they'll get hit less than most people. I like oil. Oil might go to 20. From where we are right now, depending on how bad the economy gets, but it can't stay there. It can't stay there because of general global growth, the limitations in investment. When oil goes under $50, under $70, you stop investing in the sands up in Canada, you stop investing offshore Veni in Brazil, and because the geopolitical risk says oil increasingly comes from parts of the world we don't vacation in, like the Persian Gulf, means that you'll see cyclical movement upwards in prices. I like that. I like defense. In the environment that I described, how could you not? I mean, one thing is when we start to see organizations of mercenaries going public, you're going to see a lot of growth there. But also those organizations like Blackwater train on U.S. materiel, and there'll be a lot more arms sales to organizations. Also, the Japanese at some point will remilitarize, and that means that some of those heavy industry places that will get involved in that in Japan, those corporates will probably do quite well. It's a longer-term play. You have to like a lot of the... In an environment where we see more state capitalism, there will be certain sectors that require openness to international markets or they will fail. And, you know, some of the places that require lots of collaboration of, you know, sort of scientists that are working cutting edge, your nanotechnologies, your biotechnologies, and the rest. I generally like them, but of course they're very risky. The other thing I like is Africa. A lot more corporate governance and civil society there than we had seen 20 years ago. It's still very risky, but you're starting to see consumer demand. It's not just about commodities anymore. It's also about basic durables. It's about telecommunications. Heineken makes more money per capita investor, per dollar investor in Nigeria than anywhere else in the world because 110 million Nigerians drink beer. And that's long-term a positive. I mean, you know, there's going to be a lot of risk in individual countries, but diversified Africa plays. They're small, which is hard, right? So big private equity people don't go in because you can't find many things to invest in Africa for $1 billion. But I like Africa. And by the way, Zimbabwe, when Mugabe does die, should I say if Mugabe does die, Zimbabwe is going to take off like a shot, much faster than Cuba. Because of the resources and also because of the extraordinary Zim diaspora, it's going to take advantage. By the way, that's really good news for South Africa, who will do all of the banking and who will also help with all the infrastructure and things like power sector generation and all the rest. So, I mean, South Africa longer term should be good as well. That kind of answered that question. That's a very good answer.
Yes, yeah. A very complete answer. Is it your view that the move toward state-run capitalism or state capitalism creates a better model for economies in terms of efficiency, efficient allocation of capital? Do you even look at those questions? Or are we moving toward a bureaucratic administrative model that it will just inherently be inefficient because the market will not be making these decisions?
Better is an interesting question, right? I always abhor these normative questions, but
because you asked me to be provocative.
No, I know. let me respond to in a provocative way, which is that just because fetishized hypercapitalism failed in the United States over the last 10 years, does not mean that complete absence of rule of law, and intellectual property, and state control is going to function well in China. And I think we need to recognize that the likelihood that the Chinese will be more emboldened
to actually double down on some of the things they have been doing that have been inefficient is greater in this environment. The Chinese leadership came out on Monday, and they repudiated in almost historic fashion the American political model. That is not coincidental. It's worth going and looking at the statements that were made. I think it's going to be a less efficient system. But I also would not bet on China falling apart tomorrow because they're being inefficient. There's an enormous capacity for the Chinese system to take pain. There's also a lot of support for the Chinese system among the average Chinese because they've been growing at 10% a year on average for 30 years. And by the way, they've been growing because of the Chinese leadership. And they recognize that. So you go and talk to the average Chinese and say, what do you think about China? They say, oh, we love these guys. Doing a great job. Rank them on a scale of 1 to 10. 8, 9. Nobody says 4. I mean, no, come on, Tibetans say 2. But I mean, you know, Falun Gong doesn't like it. But that's not the average Chinese. And by the way, the average Chinese is really upset about the downturn, but they're not blaming Beijing. They're blaming the West. Let's be clear. They blame Beijing at things like poison in their food and their milk powder and shoddy construction in schools in earthquake zones. Oh, that they have a beef about. But the downturn? Absolutely not. So I think we need to recognize that right now they're very strong. Here's the question. Because as they continue, one of the most interesting things about China to me is they want to industrialize. And they want to industrialize in part because we got to industrialize. They say that. I go to Beijing all the time and they say, look, you guys got cars. We want cars. My response is, but you don't get cars. Well, why not? Well, because there's 1.3 billion of you. It's not fair. It's just reality. Now, when are you going to tell your people, I'm sorry, you don't get cars? Because they're not willing to do that yet. That's a problem. That's a problem because the Chinese environment can only take so much, even for the relative development of the average Chinese. And that is a problem. But that is not a one-year or two-year problem. That is a long-term problem. And so when I say that the present system is not in equilibrium state, that does not mean that it can't go on for quite a while. It's just going to generate more shocks and crises.
Right. You commented on the outmoded nature of many of the institutions that we all rely on, that governments rely on, and so forth. So I'm assuming that you would advocate some type of new international framework of institutions. What would that look like if you were sitting down and advising Obama or advising another world leader on the next set of institutions to enable dialogue and enable progress? What would your advice be?
Well, I mean, interestingly, those are in a sense two different questions, right? Because me advising Obama requires me to deal with political reality, both domestically and internationally. So my advice to Obama would actually be stop with the healthcare, stop with the education, and just focus absolutely everything you have right now on getting Treasury up to speed, getting everyone involved. I don't care if it requires only Democrats or if it's bipartisan, and fix the financial crisis. Get liquidity going again. And if you have to ignore the international community for a while, do it, because you're not going to get new institutions. No one's going to listen to you. Don't bother with Doha, even though it's a great thing to do. Don't bother with any of this stuff. You can't do it. That is not going to solve the structural problem, but it is a structural problem. In other words, I don't think this is an issue of individual actors being good or bad. I think it's structural. So one of the reasons I'm actually in the field that I'm in is because it would be very depressing for me to be a policy advocate in this environment. It's much easier to say, in this environment, we know that certain things are coming, so what do we do about it? How do we react to those basic realities that are unfolding? We need the Security Council to go away and to be replaced with a system that does not have veto power and that actually reflects the present geopolitical realities. It is inconceivable to me that that will be set up. I mean, I was at Davos this year, and there were 42 heads of state there, 42 and a half, if you include Putin. And he's not actually technically head of state, but he does run the country. And the most heads of state that Davos had ever had before was 21. And the response was, wow, isn't this great? Look, everyone's coming. It's really important. My response was, this is a bad thing. It's a bad thing because the only reason Davos attracted all its heads of state is because actually there is a paucity of places that these people actually interact. So instead, they get this organization that is kind of appointed by this 80-plus-year-old guy in Switzerland, Klaus Schwab, who, God bless him, he's there. He's, you know, he's doing God's work. But what happens when he dies? Right? No one's taken over. Who appointed him God? Right? But there isn't any other thing. I mean, so we should be concerned or about the fact that that's where the heads of state go and not someplace else that doesn't exist.
That's my assumption. Yeah.
But as a political scientist,
yeah.
You know, what would your solution be structurally? What would the new structure look like?
Well, the new structure would reflect the geopolitical order, and it would be more flexible. So, I mean, again, you'd replace the Security Council with something that didn't have veto power and had other powers in it and could actually remove those powers relatively, you know, in short order if they fell apart. That does not mean, by the way, world government. It just means more effective capacity to build. I mean, the EU, in my perfect world, the EU would actually have common defense policy. It would be much stronger as an actor. The euro would be expanded. Turkey would be in. Right? You can't get it done. Why? Because there's no one in Europe that wants the Turks in, an Islamic country. Well, that doesn't make any sense for global peace or stability, but it makes a lot of sense because in Europe, immigration is not about economics. Right? I mean, I was in Denmark recently, and I had a bunch of Danes come over to me and say that they were prepared to accept a lower standard of living if they could get more Danishness. No one in the United States would say that because no one wants more Danishness in the United States. No one in the United States would say that we would accept a lower standard of living and kick out more Mexicans. No, they'd say they steal our jobs. Immigration policy only works in the U.S. when we can blame someone for the economy. It's not about nationalism and culture. In Europe, it is. And so as a consequence, Turkey's not in, which is incredibly stupid from an economic perspective. But it actually makes a lot of sense from a national and cultural perspective. So I'm sitting here as a political scientist talking about political risk, which is where rational people make decisions that have seriously negative economic consequences because economics is not actually the only thing they're paying attention to. And the whole point of this talk, of the book, of what I'm trying to sort of impart to the extent that I do anything, is that this is happening to a much greater degree in this world. And that is going to create a lot of volatility.
About a month ago, Martin Wolf from the Financial Times addressed a similar gathering. And he commented on the absence of leadership, economic leadership, in the world at the moment, and the fact that other countries are really looking to the U.S., and it's your point earlier about how our team is in transition and so forth. Who are the actors that you currently identify as being the most attuned to your concerns and really the best able to lead the various countries and economies out of the mess that we're in?
That's such a tough question. King Abdullah in Saudi Arabia. You know, you think about where the Saudis were a few years ago. Let me give you a heartwarming stat. One of the most positive stats in the world right now is that over 50% of incoming university students in Saudi Arabia today are women. That's astonishing, given where they were 5 years ago. Now, by the way, they can't drive, and they're not going to be treated equally. And you know, when they get out, they probably won't get great jobs. But the fact is that in terms of trajectory, they are unlocking, right, productivity of half of that population. That's an extraordinary thing. And by the way, they tend to do well because the Saudi women know this is their way up, where Saudi guys got it made anyway, right? Abdullah is sufficiently stable, has enough authority in his country, and has enough wealth in a country that only has 25 million people, that he can actually take the long term. And that is really valuable. He can appoint a woman as a cabinet minister, which he just did for the first time historically. He can spend billions of dollars in training judges to improve rule of law around the country. He can open the Saudi market to broader GCC investment. Now, these are very smart things to do.
And, you know, Saudi is an interesting place because if you go to Riyadh, which is quite conservative, Saudis will tell you that they really like Abdullah, and they'll say they like him because he's a pious man. He's not like the Shah of Iran who's out, you know, sort of whoring and gallivanting and, you know, partying during Ramadan. This is a guy who really sort of, you know, believes he's fundamentally conservative himself. He lets the Wahhabists run, you know, sort of the interior ministry and all this sort of thing. But then you go to Jeddah, which is where all of the industrialists and commercial guys are in Saudi, and they say, we love Abdullah because he brought us into the WTO, and he's doing all this stuff that supports entrepreneurship. That's pretty good. But it's in part because they're a wealthy society to get away with it. You know, Tom Friedman has this argument, and I like Tom a lot, but I disagree with him on this point, and we've argued about it. Tom Friedman has this point that petrostates, right, so countries that produce oil, that when oil prices go down, they behave more responsibly. They become more democratic. I think that is only true if the people that are running those countries believe that they can afford to take a long-term view. Because clearly, in the long term, they should become more open because that will create more wealth-generating capabilities. But if you have a government that's not sure it lasts to the long term, then they will actually crack down like crazy, because that will create more stability to get them through it. And a country like Russia, Mr. Putin, is going through that decision right now. A country like Venezuela, Mr. Chavez, is going through that decision right now. And actually, in Venezuela, not happening. Venezuela, they just nationalized cargo. Oil prices going down. By the way, they've destroyed their economy, right? I mean, in Venezuela right now, $90 is what you need oil to be to run a surplus. PDVSA is one of the most inefficient organizations in the world. They produce 500,000 barrels of oil a day, less than if any multinational oil company were actually doing the drilling, right? And yet, with oil prices going from 147 to 40, Chavez goes and nationalizes something else. Because Chavez does not have the luxury of having a long-term perspective. Given the dramatic downturn that we have just experienced, a lot of countries and leaders are finding themselves in that position. But not in the Gulf. So that's why I think that I throw a bill out there.
A little more granular. Could you comment a little further on Mexico, what you are seeing in Mexico, and your thoughts about the future there and the impact on the states?
Well, the good news about Mexico is that the Mexican people still see Calderon as fighting the good fight. So as a consequence, his popularity has stayed surprisingly high. Though López Obrador, AMLO, has also started picking up recently, and there's more populism there. The Mexican government knows they can't rely on their police forces. They are hopelessly decentralized in authority. They're outgunned. They don't have the cash, but their loyalties, they're completely infiltrated. The military is completely loyal, but they're not well trained to deal with local insurgency. You know, this is like the PLA in China dealing with Tiananmen Square, and it's a little bit like the U.S. dealing with the initial strategies in Iraq, certainly in Afghanistan. So they understand that they are fighting a losing fight right now, and it is partially about resources, but it is not only about resources. And you know, give the guy credit, Calderon is still hanging very tough. But you want to talk about fat tails. I mean, if you want to ask me, where is a country where we could see the assassination of a political leader really throw the country into a debt spiral? And Mexico's the place. Not Pakistan. Pakistan, Musharraf is gone, Bhutto was killed, and the country's actually still doing okay. Now, they don't have control over the Northwest Frontier Province or Waziristan, but the military is actually pretty cohesive. The new chief of general staff, Kiani, is actually pretty well respected. They've actually managed to solidify the intelligence forces, the ISI, in Pakistan recently. That's pretty good. In Mexico, I'm much more worried. So I think the real question will be to what extent this becomes a headline issue in the U.S. and how porous the U.S. border is and what the U.S. has to do from a National Guardsman perspective, from an FBI perspective. Because so far, when you go to Phoenix and you see all these people getting kidnapped and killed, it's all local gang and drug-related warfare. It's not affecting American citizens yet. But I also know for a fact that the U.S. government was able to avert planned attacks on the embassy in Mexico City. If that had happened, very different story. Well, I mean, you know, how lucky are we going to stay? I don't know. But I'm worried about that.
Similar question with respect to the principal countries in the EU. What is your view on the likely consequences of the current turmoil for Germany, France, and others, as you would like to comment?
Well, I said that the EU, in my perfect world, would be stronger and more coordinated. I think that would benefit them economically. But I also think we need to recognize that the existing level of coordination in Europe does have serious advantages, which is that if you are in the EU space and you go under, you will be bailed out. Right. I mean, everyone's worried about the ECB not being able to come up with sort of an advance package that will, sort of require stimulus if Hungary or Poland go down. But the reason for that is because if you're Germany, you don't want to give Hungary a vote in how German money is being spent if they fall apart. That is different from saying that Germany refuses to bail them out. They just refuse to bail them out under conditions that are dictated to them in part by other countries. But the bailout's still going to happen. And as a consequence, we feel a little more strongly about countries like Poland and Hungary. We feel a little less strongly about countries like Ukraine and Turkey that aren't actually within the EU space. Hard to make a real call on euro versus dollar. They both have problems over the medium to long term. I do think that I don't think anyone leaves the eurozone because, I mean, short of utter collapse and disaster, and if anyone leaves, it would be Germany, because they're the only ones that have a currency that would be large enough that would actually make a difference. If you're Italy, you don't leave the eurozone because you recognize that size matters, and you're done if you leave the eurozone. So that's just local political bickering. I do think that there is a danger for some of the smaller states, like Greece, to see much greater social instability that really matters. I mean, this growth of anarchists in Greece who are just calling for disorder and they're just upset and it's, leading to riots and all that sort of thing, that's a danger. And you could see more of that in a country like Spain where unemployment's like 15% right now. I'd worry about that with some of the smaller European states. I wouldn't worry about it in Germany or France or Britain in a serious way. Though the demonstrations with the G20 meetings will be very interesting and worth watching to see if we start to see a leading indicator of social instability around that, anti-globalization. Don't know, but it'll cause headlines, so we'll see. We'll see how violent they are. We'll see what it looks like.
So you've given us your thoughts on Brazil, Zimbabwe, the EU, Mexico, China. What about Russia? What do you see happening there? How do you see Russia?
I don't know. And I think the interesting thing about Russia is nobody knows, because power is consolidated in the hands of an individual. China may decide they want to change policy, but it happens slowly. China's an authoritarian state. It's very opaque. But you need consensus to move things in China, and that takes a while to build. So it's like a big supertanker. You can only move and change policy so quickly, and that's probably on balance a useful thing for global markets. Russia's not that way. If Russia decides, I mean, Putin's had the benefit of 80%+ approval ratings for a long time, and the numbers still say that, but of course they control and influence the polls. I don't think those are the real numbers. And we haven't yet seen these single company towns in Russia go under, where the companies control everything, the education, the healthcare, everything, and they're going to go under. And when that happens, you're going to see a lot of social discontent. This is this 12 to 18 month spiral that I was talking about before. How is Putin going to respond to that? This guy could put capital controls on. This guy could easily blame the West. I mean, he clearly sees benefit in provoking conflict. Russia is very interesting. There are three things about Russia that are worth identifying, in my view. The first is that Russia does not like its position presently in the geopolitical balance. They're not happy with it. Number one. Number two, the Russian government is prepared to take provocative steps to change that balance in their favor, hence Georgia and Ukraine. Number three, and perhaps most worryingly, is that the Russian leadership sees domestic benefit politically from provoking conflict internationally. There is only one other country in the world of size where those three things are true. Anyone?
Iran?
That's right. Iran. That's worrying. That makes the potential for broad outcomes and unpredictable outcomes in Russia much, much greater. So I worry about that. That was great. World Affairs Council, first answer. I'm very happy with that. I wanted just to say something a little bit reflective. Is the last time I did, my last book came out two and a half years ago, and I did a book tour, and I just started this, right? This just the book came out just on last Friday, I guess it was, and so this I've only done a couple days of the tour. But I really love to go around and actually talk to people. And two and a half years ago, so I'm comparing apples to apples, I went and I met people at World Affairs Councils and Commonwealth Clubs and town halls and stuff like that, and, you know, thousands and thousands of people. There is one immediate difference that I have noticed between then and now, and it is that the level of sophistication, of interest, and awareness of crowds on these issues now is radically higher than it was. And if you, that's actually an optimistic thing. So I think that's worth mentioning.
That actually leads to my next question. Do you consider yourself at this point on a number of these issues a voice in the wilderness in the States, or do you think that your thoughts, your advice, the issues you've identified are gaining traction among policymakers and at, in Congress?
Oh, I think they're gaining traction. I just don't think it matters. I think it's structural. So, I mean, this is the whole thing. I'm going to keep beating my head against this structural thing. I actually think when I go around, if I look at the folks that are willing to listen, you know, the fact that, you know, you'll have leadership in many countries. I mean, the Minister of Finance in Singapore asking me to come in and talk to the establishment of that country about these issues. I don't think they would have done that 5 years ago. I feel, frankly, enormously pleased that these ideas have resonance and that people are willing to really engage. Not always agree, that's not the point, but I mean, are at least willing to listen and consider. I think people are willing to consider very different sorts of arguments today than they were 5 or 10 years ago. It does not mean that they're prepared to do anything. So I don't think I'm a voice in the wilderness. I just don't think I'm going to have much impact.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, and so on behalf of the World Affairs Council, I would like to thank Ian Bremmer for providing us with his thoughts and insights. I should say the title of his book is The Fat Tail, The Power of Political Knowledge for Strategic Investing. Dr. Bremmer has agreed to stay and sign copies of his book. I would encourage all of you to do so. Thank you.
Great stuff. Thank you very much.
Very good.
By the way,